But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning, welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. Broadcasting to all you food-crazed deviants across Long Island, I'm here with producer and co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm, slightly overweight. Other than that, I'm all right. You know, just went to the doctor the other day. I do, yearly physical thing, and I must have put on about 3 or 4 pounds. And it feels like 40, you know? And it's just, my jeans are tighter, you know, and I think it's just where it went. You know, you put 3 pounds of muscle on and it wouldn't affect you, but unfortunately that's not the case with me. So I got to start paying attention again. I'm probably eating too much. I've been eating a lot of pasta for some reason. I've been craving pasta, you know, which is so much fun to make, and it's so easy, and it's, you know, it just lends itself to so many different variations that, it's hard to ignore it.
Oh, pasta's fun. It's easy to cook. The challenge of what shape to put with your sauce.
Yeah. Well, it's Italian soul food, you know. I mean, it's what. And what's funny, you know, when you go to Italy and, you know, they serve pasta with almost every meal, and they don't give you these huge portions, you know. They give you like maybe a portion the size of half of your fist or whatever. And it's enough, you know. It's enough to scratch the itch and satisfy that craving. And, nobody over there is really all that overweight, you know, due to the pasta. And I think it's the portion sizes, you know. I mean, here, you know, in a restaurant, if I don't give somebody 8 pounds of pasta, it's like they're looking at you like crazy. You know, I don't know what they do with it. If you don't eat it, you're going to take it home and make pasta sandwiches for 3 days. It's crazy.
No, what's interesting is, trying to come up with the right portion. And there's all these different variations and alternatives. I think there's tofu pasta now, which comes in bags.
Here we go.
Water.
Yeah.
Then I found something at BJ's, and it was something else, and it says, tends to smell bad.
Great, yeah.
But I found a really, really nice one, which is Hearts of Palm pasta. I usually enjoy Hearts of Palm in my salad or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was intrigued, and it comes in like foil pouches and cans, and they have three varieties. They have angel hair, linguine, and lasagna. I've only opened up the linguine one, but it tasted nice, cooks up real quick. And it helps me with portion control because
you don't have any discipline.
I have no discipline.
Ah, I see.
And then the other thing with the pasta is, and you talk about it all the time, is I guess you're supposed to make your pasta, throw the sauce in, mix it up, and then serve it.
Right.
I am a topper. I put the sauce on top.
On top.
Which means I consume a lot of extra sauce.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You talk about different pastas, you know, and this is all part of the great gluten hoax of 2021. And I say that not to offend celiac sufferers, because I know that's a real disease, and I feel bad for them, and they should be accommodated, because the effects of celiac, you know, wheat on a celiac sufferer is for real, you know. But they're probably about 5 or 10% of the people who are dealing with gluten, so fake gluten issues out there, you know, which makes us a little cynical. I mean, I had a woman a couple of weeks ago say that she wanted some gluten-free French fries. And I said, okay, I'll make them, but it's going to take about 20 minutes because I got to get new oil, you know, because the hot oil doesn't, you know, kill the gluten. And so, you know, gluten being a protein, so you have to do it in fresh oil. You know, you can't have gluten carrying French fries in that oil and then gluten-free. So when she heard it was going to take 20 minutes, she said, all right, that's fine. I'll just take the regular ones, which is, you know, just serves my, you know, narrative that, you know, most of it's fake.
That's actually very funny. But here we are. We do tape the show before the weekend.
Right.
So when our listeners will be at home listening to the show or in their cars, it's Passover weekend.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first Seder is Saturday, and Sunday's the second Seder. But all this talk about pasta is usually not a Passover
right
dish, except if you're Ashkenazi version of Jews.
Yeah, Spanish, right?
Yeah, and they, I believe, still eat pasta or can eat pasta on holiday. But my my hearts of palm pasta solves the issue for me.
There you go. You know, you're going to start a whole new tradition. You know what I mean? The stew, Schrager, Seder.
So now it's not going to be just matzo balls. I'm going to have meatballs.
You know, it's funny. I do Seders every year, you know, in the restaurants. I'll do like a separate like menu card, you know, Seder dinner, complete dinner, you know, choice of three things, app, entree, dessert. And I try and keep it somewhat traditional. Like I'll make matzo ball soup, which is kind of fun for me because it really doesn't come up in my rotation.
Sink or float?
I'm a floater. But it generally doesn't come up in my repertoire of soups because it's not what I do. So once a year when I get to make it, it's kind of fun because I can keep my matzo ball chops up, you know. And I don't make chopped liver, you know, because I can't get it past here. I can't
just make-believe you're making foie gras.
It's not the same. That's like, you know, I won't even go for an analogy there. It's not even close. It's hamburgers and hand grenades, you know. But anyway, so I'll make chopped liver, but I can't taste it. So I know how to make it, but the salt content is what's really important to me because it has to taste right. So I have to have somebody else taste it because I gag on chopped liver. I don't know what it is. And I can eat foie gras all day. It's the strangest thing. So we'll do those things, and then I'll do some kind of a salad for sure, you know. And I try and keep it somewhat traditional. Like I'll always use beets or horseradish in the salad dressing or whatever, you know, just to have that flavor there. And instead of gavelta fish, which for the life of me, I don't understand why people eat. And it's most people, it's a tradition more than I love it, you know. I find that it's older people who, I guess, kind of more grew up with it than the younger people today, you know. So I'll make quenelles or something like that, which is kind of cool.
Well, you gave me for a family Seder one year something in like almost like cupcake wrappers. I don't know if it was like a poached fish or something.
Yeah, it's kind of a quenelle thing. And, you know, like this year I'm doing something different. I'm doing a smoked fish fritter, which is kind of a fun way to, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's not gavelta fish because I think, first of all, I think it's horrible. I mean, it's a bad idea culinarily, you know. And generally, you know, it was used to, you know, pickling things was used to preserve them, you know. So it's kind of old fish, you know, in the old days. But, you know, now, I mean, if, you know, like the smoked fish fritter, you know, which I would normally use flour in. I can't use flour, so I use matzo meal, you know what I mean? But they're cool. They're like almost like a crab cake with smoked fish in them.
So Larry from Long Beach, one of our loyal listeners who responded to our conversation last week about making chopped liver and me having to run to the store to get the rendered chicken fat.
Yeah.
So he'll get a kick out of this one, but... first of all, I got to go run and get my matzo balls. I'm going to run over to Zorn's.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm going to get the matzo balls. But the Jewish food is soul food is like, but what I was going to tell the story of, and I lost my train of thought for a second, so that's why I was stumbling around.
It's a discipline part we were
talking
about.
In the old days, in the Jewish tenements, and you talk about the older people.
Yeah.
It wasn't unusual for the woman of the house who was going to be cooking to get a fish and put it in the bathtub.
Yeah.
And then she would do her thing and grind the fish,
right,
which is essentially what gefilte fish is.
Sure.
It's ground fish with
ground and pickled,
seasonings,
right?
Whatever. Yeah. And then it's got a gel to it. They somehow gel.
Yeah, it's the bones. You know, they cook the bones and make a stock.
Oh.
You know, yeah. So the bones are what really makes the fish.
So I'm actually excited because I for me it's too easy to spend money. So most of the gefilte fish is like $5 a jar.
Yeah.
I had to go with the $10 a jar because it's made with tilapia.
There you go. Yeah, which isn't a fish really. It's just, you know, it's a engineered weird thing.
Now I don't understand.
Yeah, no. But the tilapia is the cheapest fish out there. You know,
I'm telling you. Every other thing is on sale for $3.75, $4.25. I picked the one that's $9.85.
Well, I'm the same way. I always said that I could spend $10 in a pay toilet, you know.
So, and then to take it a step further, you know, everybody's making horseradish this year.
Sure, yeah.
Usually, I guess I go with golds.
Golds are great.
And there's a red and there's a white. Now, Manischewitz made it this year. Sugar-free, sweet, hot.
Nah.
And then there was even somebody else that made it. But I can't just spend $2 on my jar of horseradish.
You gotta spend 10, right?
I had to go to Stu Leonard's and get the Holy Schmitz, which was $7.99.
Nice. Good for you.
And I guess it's a farm out east, Schmitz Farm,
yeah,
and
Schmitz
they're big
farm,
with
sure, yeah,
the horseradish.
Yeah, that Holy Schmitz thing. I mean, I got the, you know, they're right on I guess it's Calverton Road or something. It's north of 25.
Okay.
You know.
So I was looking for it the other day. I mean, I got to beg to spend the money.
Yeah.
And it wasn't around. Finally, it shows up, and it was merchandised pretty poorly
because
they just threw it on the shelf. And
right,
there was a couple of different things. There was barbecue horseradish. There was beet horseradish, which is a traditional one.
Beet, I get.
There was,
yeah,
something else, but I mean, the world is crazy because there's all these different types of things. But I look forward to you know, trying this Holy Schmitz.
You look forward to a very expensive Seder is what you're looking forward to.
Oh, my goodness. Mom's not cooking everything this year, so I'm running around getting everything.
Yeah.
We needed a green vegetable. Uh-huh. So usually I go to Stu Leonard's and I get the broiled Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, yeah.
But it comes with bacon.
Oh, boy.
So
that's not good.
For the holidays, I had to ask
really
baconless.
That, right? Yeah, of course. I would expect
that. Would have no problem, to be honest.
Yeah.
Which brings another funny story. My grandmother lived in California, and we used to get out there. She was in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
And we get out there during the school breaks or whatever.
Sure, yeah,
so we went to San Francisco one year. And what's the famous marketplace out there?
Oh, the Fisherman's Wharf?
Fisherman's Wharf.
Yeah.
So I enjoy seafood.
Yeah.
So all I wanted was lobster. Now, understand, my family didn't keep kosher or anything.
Right.
So I go to order lobster or something else. There's also another flatfish, albacore?
No, flatfish is petrel sole.
But isn't there something else with an A or something?
Well, there's albacore out there, sure. Yeah.
But whatever. I go to order and my grandmother goes, "Stu, it's the holiday." Again, meanwhile, you know, during the week, we were having bacon and eggs.
Yeah, yeah. But
now it's the holiday, so I can't have my lobster.
I get it. You know what I mean? Certain traditions, you know, you're trying to keep them alive or whatever, you know. I think that what I try and do with the Seders is kind of modernize it. And I got the idea. The first Seder I ever went to was probably about, I don't know, 20 years ago. It's just that, you know, it didn't come up in my family, whatever. But I was, I have a friend of mine, Eddie Chernoff, who's a very good amateur cook and, you know, a very well-to-do guy. So he decided that he was going to have a Seder that he was going to cook. And he was going to invite, like, some of his employees and some of his friends. He had, like, 30 or 40 people to the Seder. So he rented out a restaurant for the day. And he took over the entire restaurant. So he went to the restaurant, into the kitchen. He brought all his own food. He cooked everything for the meal. And he has a very deep wine cellar. So we were drinking all these, like, first-growth Bordeaux and big Napa Chardonnays and stuff, you know, with the dinner. So he, you know, he went through the whole reading and everything else. And at the end of the day, you know, the food was fabulous because it wasn't like a regular Seder. It was just upscale thing, you know. And at the end of the day, you know, it was only he and I left at the bar because we're the only two abusers in the place, right? And, you know, God forbid there was any wine left. So anyway, we went to the bar and we're having our 50th glass of wine. And he says, you know, "Did you have fun?" I said, "You know, what was great about this, Eddie, is like there are very few instances in your life where you can have a really good time and learn something at the same time. They're usually mutually exclusive, other than the fact that you learn that you can get hungover if you drink too much, whatever." So and I said this was not only a fun meal and great friends, but, you know, I learned something about, you know, Seders in the Jewish religion, whatever. It was fun. So my girlfriend at the time, who was Jewish, was down in Florida visiting her mother, right? So she calls me up and she goes, "How did your Seder go?" You know, like kind of ha-ha-ha, you know? I said, "Well, you know, I just finished a bottle of Latour from 1982. You know what I mean? We had this Foreman Chardonnay. We had this, that." She goes, "I can't believe you. I've suffered through 35 lousy Seders in my life. You were the first one, first growth Bordeaux's," you know. So it kind of set the standard for me for Seders to come. And I decided after that year that I was going to do a Seder dinner every year at the restaurant, you know. And so I tried to kind of modernize what I thought would be, you know, my interpretation of a Seder menu. And you know, most people who came to those dinners realized that, you know, I'm not exactly Rabbi Shordell. I mean, I'm not adhering to, you know, thousands of years of tradition. I'm just trying to make something very cool and interesting.
You have more of a look of Jesus than Moses.
I know. It's, of course, especially when my hair was brown. You know what I mean? Now I'm more like Moses. You know what I mean? Moses was gray, you know. But anyway, it's a fun week for me because, like I said, I get to cook things that I normally wouldn't get. Like I'm making this apple matzah kugel, know, as for a dessert.
Yeah,
I've never made that in my life, you know what I mean? So I'm trying that this year, see how that comes out. I'll get back to you. But, you know, instead of brisket, I'm doing short ribs, you know, which is kind of the same area, you know. We always have a salmon on there, some kind of fish on there. I tend to do a chicken. I'm doing chicken with tzimmets. You know, and a little gravy. What else are we doing this year? I'm doing also a kind of a funky, because it's the time of the year, I'm doing this funky chili and citrus braised lamb shank, you know, which...
I had to go buy one of those, a lamb shank.
For the bone?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we're kind of trying to keep it, you know, somewhat traditional. I mean, you know, steeped in, you know... food that people would expect to see at a Seder, you know, like a brisket thing, you know, one year, or, you know, there's always a fish and a chicken on there. And trying to, you know, kind of, you know, filter it through my sensibility as far as food goes. And that's all it is. It's just a fun night. And you know, people who want that absolute traditional thing obviously aren't going to come to me, you know what I mean? But people who don't do, you know. So.
Well, this year actually is going to be a little strange for myself. Last year would have been the first Passover after my dad had passed away.
Right.
And as for many, Easter and Passover last year sort of was skipped over as the pandemic started to overtake our lives.
Yeah.
So flash forward a year later, this will be the first family gathering that we've really had.
Uh-huh.
My daughter got engaged over the summer, and we did a get together outside, which was pretty cool, up in Bethpage.
Yeah,
but this will be the first family gathering holiday gathering without my dad, and I'm gonna miss because I used to try to be funny all the time, and as our listeners know, I usually fall short of that. But my dad would look over and just be, stew. You know, we're trying to have a Seder here.
Yeah, it's a serious business.
Yeah. So
what's different about this night? Well, Stu finally showed up.
Yeah, that's about right.
Oh, God. Funny stuff. I think those traditions are important regardless of, you know, what your belief systems are. I mean, it's nice to keep those going and pass them from generation to generation.
But,
I think
but
it's
there
important,
are challenges,
you know?
and let's get into this. You know, Passover is the most recognizable thing is you eat matzah.
Sure.
You eat that because of traveling through the desert. They didn't have time for the
bread to rise. Yeah.
So, again, I'm not the most astute. I have a lot of problems putting butter on my matzah.
Well, yeah, and you're not supposed to use butter. You're supposed to use margarine, aren't you? Isn't butter?
No, I'm not sure. I've always used butter.
Yeah,
but I got an issue. I it's funny.
You're a matzah purist, is
my
what you're
girlfriend
telling me?
Being Kerry. Now I have to have Kerry gold butter.
Yeah. Well, corned beef, you know.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Whatever. So, but what I do is I take it out before I use it, and it eventually softens up. But I actually got to ask you a question. When I was down in Florida, I had friends that keep the butter out all the time.
Yeah, I've seen that. I don't really advocate for that much, you know.
I don't know what the spoilage factor is with butter.
Well, it's, you know, salted. The reason I don't use salted butter is because salt preserves the butter longer than it should. And, you know, you can tell when butter starts to turn because the flavor changes. So with salted butter, you don't really get that. So you don't really know if it's fresh or not.
When you go to the topic of margarine, though, I know that you can leave margarine out on a 100-degree day in the summer. and it's fine.
Well, it's made with oil. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, motor oil, I think. You know what
that's
I mean?
What
it's
I was like, leaning
yeah,
towards.
Yeah, WD-40, you know? But, it, yeah, it's, I don't know, margarine. My mother always bought it. It was probably because it was cheaper, you know, and she was always, you know, behind in money when I was growing up. So it was probably that. But, I, you know, I've seen a lot of margarine in recipes, Seder recipes and stuff. And, and I think it had to do something with parva. You know, it wasn't, butter was, you know, whatever. Or it's meat with dairy or something. Maybe it was dairy going on with the brisket.
And I have to throw this at you. There was a commercial on TV for maybe it was for a food processor, maybe it was just a product ad, but they were talking about making macaroni and cheese.
Right.
And how you have to use Velveeta because it's so creamy and
oh, yeah,
blends
it melts
so
right
well.
Away. Yeah, no, it's not even cheese. It is what it is. I don't know. Velveeta is like its own food group.
I heard that if they leave it on the machines in the factory where they process it, they have to use like hydrochloric acid to clean
to
the pots.
Off. Yeah, I don't doubt it. It's. It's an odd thing. I mean, I've used it for macaroni and cheese.
Well, you said it was color, I think, in the past.
Color, and it melts quicker, you know? I mean, you put regular cheese in there, you can be waiting for half an hour for it to get down. But, yeah, it's I'm not a big macaroni and cheese guy. I think it's kind of a, you know, an aborted attempt at pasta, you know? And then you can throw whatever you want in there, lobster, this, that, and the other thing. It still tastes like American cheese to me, you know what I mean? So why waste the lobster on macaroni and cheese? You know, why waste the bacon on it? I mean, even, you know, we do it for the kids at the club because, you know, kids eat the same thing. They eat macaroni and cheese, hot dogs, hamburgers, you know, pasta and pizza. That's pretty much it. I mean, you can, you know, even with bar mitzvahs, you know, I would put, you know, sometimes chicken parmesan or something out, you know, because we want to make it a little nicer for the kids. They'd eat french fries and burgers, sliders.
That's
well
said.
Yeah. It's no matter what you do, it is what it is, you know.
I like when I get blocked from going to the children's side of the party room.
Most of the adults are over there because it's the food they want to
well,
eat.
Well, there's at least guaranteed there's French fries.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then some chicken fingers, they, yeah, you know, they go pretty good too.
And what people don't realize is chickens don't have fingers. You know what I mean? You know, you ever seen a chicken give you the finger? You know, and they would, you because they're marching them into the killing station there. You know. No, they got wings, you know. So, it's you know, traditions like that. There's like getting back to that whole preserving them. I think it's important, and I'm not a big organized religion guy, except for the fact that I'm amazed that the more you study. Like, let's take the top three. I don't know much about the Muslim religion, but I do know something about Judaism, Catholicism, and Protestantism. And they're all, if you strip out the B and C level things, like, you know, in Jewish religion, you know, some people won't eat meat with dairy. Catholic religion, some people won't eat meat on Friday. And those were always health related, you know, when they first started. I don't think anybody's going to hell, honestly, for eating a cheeseburger and a milkshake or, you know, having a hot dog on a Friday afternoon. But, you know, when you study them, those religions, they're all pretty much the same. It's don't cheat, don't kill, don't steal, be a good person. You know what I mean? And we're all down for that. You know what I mean?
Well, I really believe no matter what religion you practice, many times religion is the outline by which to potentially live your life. It gives you order.
Yeah.
If it's about birth, it's about death, it's about sickness.
Sure.
So, but that's interesting. But so what is your ethnicity or heritage? Like when you were growing up for Easter,
right?
What was on the table? Because in today's world, I guess Italians have anything from ham and turkey and lasagna.
It does. No, they always have... It doesn't matter what holiday it is, there's pasta involved with Italians. I mean, and it should be, you know, it's fabulous. My grandmother was, I have to go back one more generation. My great-grandmother was alive until I was 13, which is unusual, you know, but she was. She lived to be very, very old. And she was actually, she was from Switzerland. And she was actually a cook in hotels in Switzerland when she was a young girl. And at that time, you know, the chauvinism didn't allow women to raise up to any, you know, particular hierarchy, you know, of authority in the kitchen. So they were always stuck in the pantry and they had, you know, the bonnets on and the aprons and they used to make the pastries and the salads and stuff like that. So as a result, she was a great baker. And she taught my grandmother how to cook. And my grandmother was really, really talented with vegetables and cakes and baking, that kind of thing.
So you were prepared during the pandemic to be able to make bread in your house now.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could do that. So anyway, my grandmother, she wasn't a very good meat cook, but she was good with pork. Anything that she could overcook, she was fabulous at, you know. Anything that required a little bit of, you know, savvy, like, you know, beef or whatever, she wasn't so good at. So, and her being from that Germanic, you know, Switzerland kind of area, we used to have a lot of roast pork and lamb, leg of lamb. But roast pork was her thing, you know what I mean?
Really? I didn't realize that roast pork sort of... Or pork was from that.
If you go to any, and there's not many German restaurants left anymore. In fact, I'm supposed to go to one Thursday for some reason. My sister is meeting two of my cousins at a German restaurant in Lindenhurst. And I don't know if there's, and I'll give you a full report next week. Or what
well, there's two. There's the one that, I don't know the name of the one you're going to, and then there's Platt Deutsch.
Yeah, in, that's in New Hyde Park or Queens Line there somewhere. Yeah, I think it's a man's name or something. I don't remember. She told me she was going to remind me on Thursday to go because I'll forget. But, you know, if you look at any German restaurant, you'll always see a bunch of pork on there. You know, pork schnitzel or roast pork or pork loin or pork chop, you know, usually with apples and sauerkraut with caraway or something along those lines. And you know, it's all the holidays we spent at my grandmother's house because, A, she was a good cook, and, B, my mother wasn't. And, you know, the grandparents want to see the grandkids.
Are you talking about the Village Lantern?
Could be. Yeah, that's a man's name, right? Village Lantern.
No, maybe
yeah.
not.
Yeah. No, I probably have it wrong, you know. But, yeah, I'm kind of excited to go because I'm a Sauerbraten fan. I love Sauerbraten. And, you know, I don't get a chance to make it. I did a German thing at the club last year, so I was able to make Sauerbraten, which is kind of fun.
And Sauerbraten is what? That's,
it's sour meat, actually. It's meat that's marinated in, you know, red wine and vinegar for 5 or 6 days, you know, some vegetables and then aromatics. And then it's cooked, and then the broth that you cook it in is the marinade. So it gets into the meat. And then the broth is thickened with crushed ginger snaps. So you have that gingery, winey, vinegary thing, which is sweet and sour.
I think the cuisine that you're talking about is incredible. I mean, my mind wanders to bratwurst and knackwurst and Wiener Schnitzel.
Well, I think that plays a big part in Jewish cuisines, too, because, you know, there's so many
Eastern
European and German. And, you know, there's a lot of German Jews. There's a lot of Eastern European Jews. So a lot of food is kind of the same, you know, and fun. I mean, I wouldn't want it every day because, you know, I probably wouldn't live past 60. But, you know, it's nice to have once in a while. And it reminds me of my grandparents. You know, I'm sure, you know, a Seder reminds you of your dad, your grandparents.
Well, you were talking about going back. You said your great grandmother.
Yeah.
And I guess in Yiddish, which is Jewish folklore language.
Yeah, it's pig Latin, and you know.
But our great grandmother would be Bubba.
Yeah, sure.
And Bubba lived with my father's aunt.
Yeah.
And she was an old lady, walked around, and you know, like it was like a vision of the past.
Yeah, for sure.
But you'd walk in there, and she'd be throwing things around on the stove or whatever. But it was marvelous.
Yeah, they knew how to cook.
And my mom, who's a really good cook, would always want to get the recipe.
Yeah.
A pinch of this and a dish of that and dish of do.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody about that the other day, and she was saying that, you know, I'm trying to learn this thing, but, you know, I don't have the amounts. And I'm like, listen, if you want to learn how to cook, forget amounts. When I teach cooking classes, I don't give amounts. And I do it on purpose because I'm trying to teach technique. And once you have technique, it doesn't matter about the amounts. You'll figure it out. You know what I mean? And if you only do amounts, and if you don't have the amounts handy at the time, you can't execute the dish. So technique is much more important than amounts. It's the same with guitar. I mean, if you teach technique, you know, the rest will come. You know what I mean? If you don't, you're going to be stumbling around.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because that's a whole interesting conversation. In today's digital world, when people are talking about photography,
mm-hmm.
you don't need to know how to develop film.
Right.
Yet, they say that if you really want to get the knowledge of what photography is all about, you need to learn about the apertures and this, that, and the other, and the development.
Sure. Yeah.
Developing procedure.
You gotta dive in.
But it's also with music, you know, it's different to be able to do something electronically or know where the original sound came from.
I think the problem is that, you know, in the world that we live in now, there's such immediate gratification that nobody has the patience to study anymore, regardless of the subject. I have a friend who has a music store in Huntington, and he was lamenting the fact that he used to have 500 guitar students, and now he's under 200. And that has to do with the fact that it's not, you don't get it immediately. But you can buy this Guitar Hero thing, you know, from Model or whatever, and you can, you know, play a song by pressing the blue button or the red button or the green button or whatever, you know. And people think they're playing guitar, and they're not. And it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of patience. You know, I studied Kung Fu for years, right? Kung Fu means time and effort, literally translated. And it's the same thing with, you know, anything that you want to learn.
Absolutely. When I got divorced, I had a little bit of time on my hands, and I worked with...
And much more relaxed, probably.
Probably was. I went from a very stressful life to a very appreciative, relaxed life.
In other words, you were sitting in your apartment with no money and nothing to do.
There you go. But
you
so
know what the
great
part about living alone is? There's nobody to bother you.
That's true.
You know what the terrible part is? The only time living alone is a problem is if you need a kidney. You know what I mean? You got nobody to go to.
Well said. But through the radio station, I was calling on Westbury Music Fair and became very close with the management there. And I found out that one of the marketing people's father was a guitar teacher in Lynbrook or Valley Stream. And my dad was an importer of guitars when I was growing up. And in those days, there was nothing that wasn't branded, you know. Everything was like, and the Beatles came and got crazy. But so I had a little bit of experience with guitar. I took lessons way back when.
Right.
And I don't think I practiced back then either. But I truly understood what you just said. I took the lessons, but I didn't practice.
Yeah, well, it's...
And it was sort of a waste because... I wasn't accomplishing what I should have been able to accomplish.
Well, they have that 10,000-hour thing out there, you know, that you got to spend 10,000 hours to be an expert at anything. And it's probably true. I mean, you know, I may be close to 10,000 hours on a guitar. I'm probably close to 400,000 in the kitchen because I've spent, you know, 53 years or whatever it is, you know, 12 hours a day. At one point, 6 days a week. Now it's, you know, sometimes six, sometimes five. But when you count those hours up, I mean, it's a massive amount of time. And you can't help but, you know, if you're doing it every day, get better at it, you know, hopefully, you know. Some people I've seen, not it doesn't work, but, you know, I've had some cooks that, you know, I have my fingers in my eyes. You know, you should be working for the county here. This is obviously not for you, you know. But it makes you, retrospectively, when I look back, I mean, I was just looking through old menus. I was cleaning out an area at my house out east, and I have a box of menus that I've collected over the years, you know, some from places that I worked, some from things that, you know, great meals that I've had all over the country, whatever. And I was looking at a menu, see how much things have changed, and, you know, just looking at the items, you know, how cooking's changed. And you look at the prices. And I was looking at a menu from a place that I worked at in 1969, and I remember this vividly because I remember the conversation. I was in on the conversation. And twin 8-ounce lobster tails were $4.95
on the menu. If I'm not mistaken, you could get pizza and a drink for $1
in the
old days.
Sure.
And now a bagel is $1.25, bagel.
And I'm older than you, so I go back even further. And the conversation I started to allude to was, I remember the boss coming in to talk to the chef, Shorty, who was a complete maniac. I don't even know what Shorty's opinion, because Shorty was nuts, you know. But anyway, he says, you know, I have to raise the price of the lobster tails to $5.95 because of what they cost. But I don't know if anybody's going to pay $5.95 for twin lobster tails. And here I am in 2021 laughing. You know, people are paying $75, $85, you know, dollars.
Yeah, but that be said, I don't think I'm wrong. 1962, 1964, a house on the South Shore was like $24,000. And people had to like beg, borrow, and steal from family members to be able to make the down payment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember my parents moving to Carl Place, and I guess it was 59. I don't know what they paid. I think they paid, you know, 12 grand or whatever that was for the house. And my father was sweating the payments all the time, you know. It's all, you know, now, I mean, my grandfather, I remember, couldn't understand how a starter home on Long Island is $500,000 before he died.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't get, I had a conversation with him before he passed away. My grandfather lived to be 101, right? So when he was like 98 or 9 or whatever, I'm down in Florida, I'm talking to him, and all he was worried about was his grapefruit tree in the back. He had his grapefruit tree, and my grandfather, he never really was a conversationalist. He was the kindest, greatest guy. I mean, I spent a lot of time with him when I was a kid, but he was a quiet guy, you know? And if he wasn't talking about the weather, he was talking about his grapefruit tree, right? So he takes me out in the back and he goes, you know, last year I had 752 grapefruits out of this tree. This year it's looking like it's going to be somewhere around 537. But I think next year's the year, I think I can get to 800 pieces. And I'm sitting there with my fingers in my eyes going, listen, Pop, as interesting as this grapefruit conversation is, it just dawned on me, you're going to be 100, so you've seen an entire century, you know? And he goes, yeah. I said, so what's the biggest mind screw for you that, you know, that you just can't wrap your head around, you know? And I'm thinking it's going to be nuclear fission or, you know, the cell phone or whatever. He goes, it's the price of money, the cost of money. He goes, I can't understand it. He relates everything to baseball and stuff. So he goes, when did a shortstop batting 240 be worth $30 million. Like, I don't know. I said, but, and he couldn't get through the house on Long Island because he bought his house. It was $6,000 in Flushing, you know.
Well,
He just couldn't wrap his head around it.
Just like when I was divorced and went back to live with mom and dad, and I was carless and said I needed to buy a car, and grandma, you know, came through with $20.
Yeah. That's when you should have been studying guitar, when you had the time to explore all those flavors, you know? Yeah, I think that's, you know, when you take up music as a child, and I think that's one of the greatest gifts, you know, I don't know what this has to do with food, but here I go again. You know, one of the greatest gifts you can give children is a musical education, because it enriches their lives in so many ways. You know, music is math. I mean, you can't help but become better at math if you study music. So it's got this double edge thing.
Oh, you just said a mouthful. So,
see, that's food. We're back on it again. All right, Stu. Thanks for bringing us back.
So Carrie's kids always say to me, and Carrie even says it, you know, all the different things she learned, she had to learn in school.
Yeah.
And what does it mean today?
Right.
And I might be oversimplistic, but I believe that all these different things we learned, if nothing less than mind exercise.
Yeah.
And teaching you how to learn,
yeah,
how to be able to accept, how to, again, just understand how everything comes together. So
sure,
you might not use trigonometry, but you've been opened up to accept new thoughts and ideas. And I guess it's a pretty abstract thought, but all the time they just always say, you know, why am I learning this? I'm never going to have to use it.
Yeah, when was the last time you diagrammed a sentence? You
right.
know? Yeah. But I think the brain is a muscle that has to be exercised like any other, you know? You know, my granddaughter, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting there, and she has this little guitar that I bought her, you know? And you can't tune it. Thing's a piece of crap, you know? But, you know, she likes strumming on it and thinks she's playing. And she says to me, Paco, I want you to teach me how to play guitar. And the problem is she's a little too young. She's 5, you know, which I guess some kids can start at that age. But I'm not a good teacher. So, I mean, I can show her some stuff, but her hands aren't big enough to get around, you know?
See, that's actually my problem. I don't know that I would ever be a good guitar player. I think I have small hands.
Doesn't matter.
But when I go around the neck to do the chords, I don't think that I have a large enough hand to have the dexterity that is necessary.
You do. They make different size necks. I mean, some necks are wider and fatter than others, you know.
Thanks. I thought I had a good excuse.
No, you don't. I mean, one of the best guitar players I know, a guy named Bosco out in East Hampton, has very small hands, and he's a monster, you know. So it's just a question of application. You know, you got to apply your physical, gifts or lack thereof to the instrument itself. I mean, I have 30 guitars home. You know, and they're all different sizes and shapes, and so I prefer some necks over others for whatever reason. They're easier to play for me, you know. I have guys who have, you know, hands smaller than mine that like bigger necks for whatever reason, you know. It's just a comfort thing you'll find, you know. And it's the same, believe it or not, getting back to food, it's the same thing with pots and pans. I mean, I've seen these pots that they sell. Like, I was a spokesmodel for Volrath for a while, you know, and Gold's Horseradish, by the way, too, for about an hour. But anyway, they used to bring me into malls to you know, pitch these pots, you know. And, you know, I won't say the name of it because, you know, it wasn't Volrath. Volrath is commercial. I couldn't think of the name, and I got it now. But I'm not going to say it because it doesn't matter and not pay me anymore anyway. So, but they used to take me to malls and do these cooking demos with these pots and pans. And they were very expensive, and but I thought they were poorly made. The handle was bent, like it was kind of had a crescent shape to it, and it was thin, and it would wiggle back and forth in my hand. It was like you couldn't really get a good grip on it. And they were pretty for sure, you know, but impractical.
That's so funny. Again, go back in time. Growing up, I grew up in the 60s. I think there was like two companies that made pots and pans. There was Revealware,
yeah,
and that had the copper bottom, right. And then there was the one that was all silver. And then, like, your family had either that or that.
Yeah, and you know, they make these pots with such thin bottoms, and you know, I can't cook in a thin bottom pot. I mean, I have three at one of my restaurants. I have three of these big braziers, they call them, not like a bra, like a BR. It's spelled differently. It sounds like a bra, but it's not. It's a brazier, you know, which sounds like a bra. But anyway, I have a big one. It's like a H cup, you know. It's a massive, you know, thing. And I have three of them. And one of them has a thinner, you know, bottom that I inherited. And I always wind up burning something in there because it just doesn't hold the heat. You need thicker bottom pots for almost everything you do, you know. And I encourage people out there, if you're listening, if you're in the pot buying mode, make sure there's a thicker bottom on those pots. It'll improve your cooking 80%.
In the old days, there wasn't non-stick pots and pans.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Teflon came about, which I think was a poison, as it turns out.
Yeah, they were saying it was contributing to Alzheimer's, you know. Which is good because then you forgot you burnt it, you know.
I think it was a DuPont product.
It was probably some chemical in there or whatever, you know. I don't know. I use them. I think they're safe now as far as I know, you know.
I go back to Thanksgiving visiting you at the kitchen at the club that you're associated with. And it was just so impressive. I mean, you have all these different pots and pans laid out strategically. And as you did the cooking demo, you know, just reaching for this and reaching for that, and you need a cover, so you use another pan for the cover. And
yeah,
it was like a conductor, leading the band.
It's all experience, you know. I have a friend, and he has this. You know, he's able to do whatever he does. He explained it to me once, a hedge fundy thing or whatever. I don't know. My eyes glaze over. I just have no interest whatsoever. It's probably why I'm broke all the time. But anyway, he's giving me this whole lecture on what he does. And I said, I can't even imagine doing that. And then I'm thinking how impressive he is. And then a thought comes into my head. I bet you he couldn't cater a wedding for 2,500 people. I can do that. You know what I mean? He can't do that. So it's about what you know. So when you come into my kitchen, what it looks like is 52 years of getting my ass kicked, you know what I mean, and figuring out that, you know, that should probably go there and this should probably go here. It's a trial and error situation. It's constantly in motion, you know?
It's funny that the vision that just came to mind, you're talking about all that, and now that the pandemic is sort of winding down a little bit, it seems.
Yeah.
And restrictions are loosening up, and now there are people are having parties and weddings at the different catering halls.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the food at a catering hall could be better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now people are going to be so excited to
have just
this,
to get
like,
out. Yeah, you can get away with anything
food.
Now. Yeah. See, I'm not one of those guys that runs around in the woods, you know what I mean, in camouflage and shooting up birds or whatever they do up there, you know, government conspiracy guys. But I'm always kind of aware of usurping power, you know. I'm constantly vigilant, I guess, is the word, you know. I don't want this to turn into the Soviet Union here.
No, but everything is so confusing. I mean, it seems that more and more people are getting vaccinated.
Right.
It's supposed to be getting easier. There's all these new vaccination centers. Yet I know from dealing with different municipalities and different aspects of local government, I heard something ridiculous, you know. this one location. Well, they got their trial because they needed to do the logistics of being able to register people or whatever.
Yeah.
And then the first weeks of vaccines never came through.
Well, what disturbs me even more is I was watching the TV late one night or whatever. I had a news channel on, and they had President Biden and Vice President Harris in a room by themselves, 20 feet apart, both vaccinated with masks on. So the message is either continue to wear the masks and submit, or the vaccination is useless and I need the mask anyway.
Well, yeah, and to that point, I was watching, I think this was last Sunday, Face the Nation or whatever, and one of the news programs, but they had Fauci was being, I guess, questioned by Congress or whatever, and they're busy assaulting him about the theatrics of wearing masks. You know, and Fauci's got his mask there or whatever, and then the congressperson is busy lamenting him about it's not needed, this, that, and the other. And
I think the mask is kind of, it's a little scary to me because I think it's submission to some degree. And you know, I'm reading things. It was something in Bloomberg the other day that said, be prepared for, you know, an ongoing pandemic. It's always going to be with us. You know, it's never going away. And as soon as you get some good news, right? Like, okay, we got the vaccine and people are going to be okay. Oh, we got a strain from South Africa. No, keep the mask on. We
right,
have a strain
the Brazilian
from England. Now we have the Brazilian, which I thought that was a shaving thing, but now I find out, no, they have more than one thing.
I'm glad you said that and I didn't, but I was thinking that.
Well, yeah, of course, you know what I mean? Here comes the FCC again, you know? We got the Brazilian strain. I'm like, yeah, that's cool, man. You know? No, it isn't. Oh, God, you know? Anyway, but I worry that, you know, every time the government type sees a little power, they never really give it back. And the more they can tell you what to do, the more they're going to do it.
Well, I think we talked about that last week. It's actually true. Use Cuomo as an example. At the beginning of the pandemic, they granted him special powers to make emergency decisions.
Yeah.
And they're busy fighting to try to rescind that now because they feel that the emergency, although the pandemic's not over, the critical part might be.
Yeah.
So if they need to reenact the emergency sanctions, that's fine.
Yeah.
But let go for the moment.
They don't want to let go. I mean, here's all the proof you need. Cite me one government bureaucracy that was ever established to solve a problem that solved it and disbanded.
But I have actually had an interesting thing this week, and I give credit to Laura Curran, the Nassau County executive. They opened up the Coliseum
right.
as a vaccination center. And we were talking, and I asked her if she has gotten vaccinated yet. And obviously, she has the wherewithal to get vaccinated
sure.
if she wanted to.
Right.
And it's not that she doesn't want to. She's trying to be one amongst
yeah, like
everybody.
Follow the rules. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And she goes, no, I'm actually getting it in next week.
Good for her.
And I said, wow, that's pretty, you know, and she's been out and about. She's actually had a quarantine a couple of times because
yeah.
she was in proximity of somebody
sure.
that tested positive or whatever. But I thought, wow, you know, here's somebody that sort of entered local politics during her first term. And I thought she's navigating through it pretty well, and that sort of was the icing on the cake when she said, no, I haven't been vaccinated yet.
Well,
and I guess we're approaching November, where I guess the county executive race in Nassau County is
going
to happen again.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see if she gets kudos for the leading us through the pandemic or if this whole thing with property tax assessment is going to
derail her. Well, here's going back to my vigilance on government is that you're expressing, you know, dismay / appreciation for a government official who's basically living by the rules that she set.
Right.
Because it's so unusual, you know what I mean? As opposed to Cuomo, who's sending state troopers to his brother's house with vaccines, you know, ahead of, you know, the schedule. And
there was something going on during the past 12 months that there was a state trooper or somebody on his security detail that went out on a date with his daughter or something.
Yikes.
And he's on the Canadian border right now. This is not hearsay. This was really happening.
Yeah, this is the abuse of power. That, you know, that's why I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a term limit guy. You got to get these people out of here. If you can't have a president for more than 4 years, why do you have congressmen down there for 50? They're more powerful than a president when it comes to making law. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but Trump figured this out. You know, he doesn't have to worry about how many. Because I don't think there's any limit on how many times you can be president.
Or is it
a consecutive thing?
No, you can only serve two terms, whether it's consecutive or non-consecutive. You can only serve two terms.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
No problem. It's just welcome to the Politics on Fire show here. My rear end's going to be on fire by the end of this show. But it drives me crazy to watch these people operate down here. You know, you get people make $175,000 a year worth $20 million. How's that happen? You know, I made more than that. I'm nowhere near that number, you know. So it's just, we all know what's going on, and yet we're too lazy to fix it, you know. I mean, the thing is, you know, I was always, term limits kind of weird. Just vote them out. But nobody's going to vote anybody out because they keep promising you free stuff. So you don't vote out anybody. You know, I mean, now you have 50% of the people who vote for a living at this point, you know. And they're never going to not vote for somebody who's going to give them free stuff.
That makes me think back. I'm told, and again, sometimes I'm just a puppet, but during Obama's, campaign for his second term, he loosened up the regulations about food stamps or whatever so that more people could get it. And in theory, that's a great thing. But I guess the critics were saying that the reason he did that is he was luring more people to vote for him.
Creating dependency, of course, yeah. I mean, listen, the whole immigration thing, you know, I've been on the forefront of this for 50 years. I mean, you know, I work with immigrants all the time. You know, if you made legal immigration easier and illegal immigration harder, you would solve the problem at the border. But they won't do that. Why?
Yeah, but there's such confusion now. The border's open. The border's closed. Send the kids. Don't.
Yeah, it's open. I mean, you know, they can say what they want. It's open. Look what's going on. I mean, you know, it's like. And you think, how does a 9-year-old walk 1,500 miles by himself? I mean, you think this isn't a business? I mean, these people, who's feeding these people on the way up?
Well, we know it's a business.
You're enriching the cartels.
That terrible van accident a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Apparently, there were two vans that drove through a hole in the wall. One immediately went on fire.
Yeah.
And the other one, unfortunately, was a T-bone by a tractor trailer.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's and it's all about, you know, there were 20 people in an SUV that normally would hold 8 if you used all the seats.
It's always the same story, man. You know, I this never gets reported. You know, unless if Trump was in office at the time, they'd be screaming from the top of the New York Times building about, you know, how terrible this is, and the other thing. And I don't really care which side you come down on this on. There should be fair reporting on both sides, and just tell us what's going on so people can make informed decisions. But you don't have news anymore. You have journalism anymore. You have advocacy. You know, it has to be I have a cousin who's a Pulitzer Prize winning correspondent for Washington Post. So I know a little bit about this, you know, how it works. And he was saying years ago, I mean, for him to make his bones, he had to do 6, 7, 8 years before they would let him anywhere near a White House press corps or anything like that. Now, if you're the right color, the right gender, it's all about show. There's no journalism anymore. It's all advocacy,
And again, it's all about education. But I'm definitely not up on all the regulations about immigration, but I wonder how different it was back when we talked about my Bubba and your great, you know, when they came over. I guess there was easier regulations or to understand regulations.
Well, there was only one way to come. You had to come through Ellis Island. You had to be vetted. I mean, if you were sick, they wouldn't let you in. If you had tuberculosis, they wouldn't let you in. If you could sustain yourself, they would. If you didn't have any way to, you know, if you were coming in as a ward of the state, they wouldn't let you in.
And then your heart falls out of your chest when you hear some of the stories about the immigrants that are trying to come here.
It's terrible.
And the backlash that if they are actually fortunate to get in here, but the people that are left back in their country, because they might have aided and abetted their family to
sure.
get here.
Yeah, yeah.
The repercussions on them. It's just.
And how painful is it for these people? I mean, people in Guatemala don't love their children any less than we do. I mean, you know, I mean, to let a 9-year-old go on a 1,500-mile jaunt with a stranger, I mean, that's desperation, obviously.
And then all the craziness of if somebody comes over here pregnant or gives birth here, the child automatically
citizenship,
is a citizen.
Yeah, yeah.
But the parent might be susceptible to having to be deported.
Well,
the craziness, emotional strain on an individual.
It's horrible. And getting it back to food, I mean, the great part about immigration is the things they bring with them. You know, the culinary traditions that they bring with them, the Italians, the Jews, forget the English. But, you know, I mean, Chinese and, you know, all these immigrants have brought their food with them and it's enriched the American menu.
For sure. My kids grew up on the North Shore and it was such a mixed socioeconomic, ethnic. My children learned about Indian cuisine,
sure, yeah.
Muslim cuisine, Italian, and things that were not so extravagant, but then all of a sudden things get opened up to more and more.
It's the food version of the melting pot that we always were told this country is, you know,
which is
great.
And like when we grew up, it was Chinese food.
Yeah,
today's
yeah.
world.
On Sunday,
yeah. But in today's world, then I know as I grew up, then there was Szechuan food became popular, and Cantonese, I guess, was the more traditional.
Sure.
But then you get involved with Thai cuisine and Vietnamese cuisine. I mean, it's fabulous, all the different varieties and opportunities we have to explore and allow our palates to experience all this.
Sure. Just look at a market. I mean, you know, there was this Associated grocery store in Carl Place when I was growing up, and you go there, and it was the same four things that they had in the meat counter and two fish or whatever. Now you go to pick one, Wild by Nature or whatever, and it's just this, all these things that you never saw as a kid. I mean, fennel and jicama and, you know, all these ethnicity.
But at what point
foods.
Do you draw the line, as you famously say, you know, at one point, when does fusion become
confusion? Yeah, most when people don't know how to use the ingredients and they're sticking things together that normally don't belong together. You know, so I think that's the difference. You know, fusion's cool until it becomes confusion, and then it's not. It's just silly. And it usually comes from a chef who really doesn't have a handle on it, who's trying to put things together for the sake of shock and awe, for the sake of art or whatever, and then it becomes this confused thing. And now they get all kinds of laws now against appropriating cultures. The whole thing has gone nuts. If I were to open up a Japanese restaurant right now, I probably know as much about Japanese food as that, you know, some of the Japanese guys, but I would be accused of appropriating, you know, the culture's food. The whole thing is so ridiculous.
No, I sort of draw the line, and I guess I told you the story of somebody that was trying to make a diet-friendly Reuben sandwich.
It's impossible.
And it was the
oxymoron.
It was Russian dressing, the corned beef, the sauerkraut, and it was wrapped and Swiss cheese, and it was wrapped
in whole
lettuce.
Wheat wrap or something.
But to me, where I draw the line though is I think there was a Reuben egg roll or something like that. But I just got to ask you one quick question.
Make it quick. We got to go.
You talked about your grandmother in Switzerland. I went to the store the other day, and they had baby Swiss.
Really?
What is baby Swiss?
It's Swiss that hasn't grown up yet. I mean, you know.
And with that, what a Tom's.
We're going to close Tom's three keys to life. Life is too short to talk to Stu. Keep chocolate in your... Let's start over. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And next week, if you remind me, I'll tell you about bologna sushi.
Okay, happy Passover to all our listeners, and next week, Easter.
Yeah, there you go.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.